Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Coming up on the show, our education reporter Tennessee Watson explores how sexual violence reports fall through the cracks at UW.
So if a student doesn't hear from you, then we know that there's like a broken link somewhere.
Probably.
A lack of affordable housing in Cheyenne is causing the two homeless shelters to operate at full capacity each night.
There's just nowhere for them to go.
And as agencies struggle with what to do with the hundreds of wilderness study areas in the Mountain West, one U.S. senator is taking action.
I feel he took the bull by the horns and said, we need to make a decision.
Those stories and a wrap-up of the 2018 legislative session, it's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. The Wyoming legislative session is coming to a close. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck joins me now to discuss the session. Thanks for being here, Bob.
Thank you.
There was a lot of talk about the lack of revenue coming into the session and how that might impact things. How did that play out?
Well, it certainly did. It was a discussion in the Senate and the House, but maybe more so in the Senate. Senators very concerned about the future of funding. But one of the things that also didn't come up in the Senate was revenue. The general feeling there is that they shouldn't raise taxes and need to cut and do whatever they can to avoid tax increases. The House, on the other hand, said, okay, maybe not taxes, but let's take a look at some new ways to grab some revenue to fund some of the state government. And one of those would be some of the taxes we get, tax revenue we get from online sales that are taking place through Amazon and that kind of thing that are finally getting returned to the state of Wyoming. There was some diversion of money that they put into some different funds, maybe start using that money again since the state needs it. And so that was the debate, and there was a lot of that debate. And Senator Eli Bebout, who's the Senate president, certainly had a very strong opinion about raising any revenue, and he wanted to either cut money or take it out of the reserve account. And that was the stance that the Senate took. And the House, of course, took a bit of a position where you needed to cut some, but really didn't do a lot of cutting. And so that was kind of what played out through the entire session. It's led to some interesting conference committees and discussions, and certainly hung up the budget, which we'll talk about in just a second. But that was the theme. When all said and done, I think probably the House did better than the Senate when you look at all of that. But the Senate's position of cutting some things, certainly does play forward.
At one point, education was facing some serious cuts. If everything kind of holds, how will things stand?
Probably about a $30 million cut to education. There was a point where that was looking much, much higher than that, and certainly had some school districts concerned. And plus, though there were also a couple of constitutional amendments floating out there that would maybe allow the legislature to make even further cuts than the model allows right now, and also limit school construction, or at least make it so the state of Wyoming did not have to pay for school construction. So it would be basically tax issues at the local level. So that's what they were hoping to accomplish with those. The House wanted nothing to do with that, and so most of those failed.
Why did those cuts not fly in the House?
It's pretty easy. The Speaker of the House is an educator. His name is Steve Harshman, and there also were some other people in the House that really were vested on education and really didn't think further cuts were the way to go. The other thing that happened in the House, I think maybe more so in the Senate, is that there were maybe more people in the House of Representatives that had hoped that the House Revenue Committee would come back with some tax money or at least some new revenue options. And, you know, they were very unhappy that that didn't happen. And so they really didn't want to vote for any cuts. And so that was kind of the discussion over on the House side. And as far as cutting back on education a lot, you know, David Northrup, who is the education chairman, he led the way of getting rid of a lot of the House or the Senate bills that would have done just that. So it was just tough sledding for the Senate over in the House.
There have been some reports that the Speaker, Steve Harshman, and Senate President Eli Bebout did not get along. Did any of that dynamic move to the rest of the House and Senate?
Well, first off, that's true, and that they didn't get along, and there was certainly a different philosophy. Senator Bebout is old school and believes you cut the budget, you don't raise revenue. Steve Harshman certainly agrees with cutting the budget to some extent, but he thinks it's time to start paying for things again. And he had hoped that the House Revenue Committee would come back with some ideas, but they just didn't do it. And I think what happened is the budget picture improved a little bit for the state of Wyoming over the summer. And so it's an election year. Who the heck wants to pass a tax and get tagged as a tax and spend this type of person during an upcoming election? And so, you know, there was a lot of that that went on. Now, did that affect the relationship between senators and representatives? No. In fact, it was a main topic of discussion that, well, I think we've reached a deal on this, but let's see what, you know, the leadership thinks about this. So there was a lot of that kind of conversation. But everybody got along and everybody actually found some of those disagreements funny.
Some tensions, certainly. But what were some of the highlights and high points of the session? Maybe some things to be excited about.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing to talk about, because there's some weird bills, certainly, and there was some in here on the final day that are still floating around. But I do think that there was some very good legislation. You know, if you're looking to improve the economy, one thing you want to see in this state is enhanced broadband and better airline service. Legislation to maybe do that did pass. There was also some endow initiatives that did some other things, such as funding for entrepreneurs, providing grant money, which is something that has been lacking in the state. And it's something that probably will move more to the private sector down the road, but at least getting some of that started. They also did some other things. You know, there was some work being done on the opioid problem in our state. There's going to be a commission that's going to get together and take a look at that. And then there was some legislation to better track some of the medication that's handed out to folks so they can get a handle on some of those things. And so some good stuff there. And then I think on the education side, the one that really is useful is, you know, adding computer science into the basket of goods, so it's something students can take and maybe learn about coding and that kind of thing, and possibly get them ready to go if they want to be young entrepreneurs and that sort of thing. So certainly a lot of good did happen during the legislative session. It really wasn't all that bad.
The 2018 session is almost in the books. So what's next for lawmakers? What's in store for them?
I would say that the thing that's next for them, they really have to get back to this revenue piece, because they're right. They can't keep cutting the budget there. And I haven't seen the latest numbers, but it's over $700 million that they're going to take out of their reserve account. They came into the session with $1.5 billion. So they've, you know, you don't want to keep doing that over the next couple of years. But, you know, they have money and they have some time. So eventually, let's get through the election season and see what you want to do. And later in this program, Senator Rothfuss and Senator Coe will lay some of that out for some of the audience on things that they would like to see. But, you know, making sure that everybody is paying into the tax system, other businesses, and there's a lot of exemptions that are sitting out there, a lot of people that really don't pay maybe as much as they should, some of the businesses that are doing very well in the state. So that might be something that they want to take a look at here down the road, and I think that will be very important. And, you know, I just think the time of cutting, Caroline, that maybe there's more cuts, but I think they've really taken a good whack at things over the last 4 or 5 years, and maybe it's now time to reassess what are our priorities and how do you pay for them. It sounds very simple. It's not simple in government.
Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has been reporting from the 2018 legislative session. Thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you.
When we return, we'll hear about wilderness study areas scattered across the Mountain West and a conversation touching on this week's news in energy. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Dotted across the Mountain West are huge swaths of federal land called wilderness study areas. They aren't protected wilderness, but they're under review to see if they can be upgraded to that. But many of those reviews happened decades ago, and for the most part, Congress never took action. That means many of these lands are managed like wilderness. No mining, logging, and in some cases, no motorized vehicles. They're protected. Now, a U.S. senator from the Mountain West is taking action. Some folks are happy with his idea, others, not so much. The Mountain West's News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports.
Life's been tough on Chris Marchand. There was a high school football injury, the knee replacement.
Unfortunately, I got a hip that's wore out.
We're standing alongside a gravel road near a cow pasture. And nowadays, this is about as close as Marchand can get to the Sapphire Wilderness Study Area. You can see it out there in the distance, a clump of rolling gray mountains.
So this is Emmerine Mountain. It's in the clouds. That's where the...
Marchand grew up in a nearby mining town, and he says back then the Sapphires were an escape.
If you think about being confined in a mine or in a smelter, your day off to be out somewhere where there's blue sky and trees and, you know, clean water.
It meant a lot, but nowadays Marchand believes the Sapphire Wilderness Study Area is in trouble. There's legislation moving through Congress that would strip away protections for it and some other wilderness study areas in Montana. If passed, it would open these lands to more motorized vehicles and even potential mining. Steve Daines introduced the legislation and says it's long overdue. Daines is a Republican and one of Montana's U.S. senators.
It should have been done shortly after 1982. And what we're doing here, I think, is pretty common sense. We're just looking at those areas that have been deemed not suitable for wilderness to release those.
At an ATV store in Phillipsburg, Montana, I meet up with Stan Spencer. He's a snowmobiler.
You know, I've been riding in the backcountry since, you know, the early 80s. I hate to admit it, but I am 74 years old, and I still enjoy getting back out there. That's my thing.
But he says he can't snowmobile in many wilderness study areas if they're managed like de facto wilderness. So he's really happy about Daines' legislation.
I feel he took the bull by the horns and said, we need to make a decision.
Still, conservationists are frustrated Senator Daines never held public meetings before introducing his legislation. Plus, it eliminates study areas without creating new wilderness. Paul Spittler is with the Wilderness Society, a conservation group. He says one-sided legislation like this has never passed Congress.
They generally receive a lot of public opposition.
And there's some history to back that up. A similar Wyoming bill never made it to the president's desk, while Idaho took a more balanced approach that did.
It was a collaborative effort between ranchers, conservation interests, county commissioners, and others. And so they sat down and ultimately reached agreement. Some of these areas would be designated as wilderness. Some of the areas would be removed from wilderness study area status, and everyone came out ahead.
But the current legislation won't create any new wilderness. Daines counters that's because it's about restoring balance. He says Congress has only eliminated 150,000 acres worth of wilderness study areas in Montana. At the same time, he says, it's created more than 1 million acres of new wilderness there.
It seems like it's kind of a one-sided, it's like we only are adding wilderness right now in our state. That's what I've supported that. I'm just saying, if you listen to tens of thousands of Montanans who are very concerned about the fact that the state is getting out of balance.
Back at the edge of the Sapphire Wilderness Study Area, Chris Marchand is watching a herd of elk move across a valley.
I got my binoculars here, but see, there's a whole bunch of elk.
He's 65 years old, and he hopes these lands will remain protected.
I can't do as many things as I used to. Some of these areas I'll never go back and see as much as I did when I was younger. But the fact to be out there and know that they still exist and that other people can go have the experiences I had, that's really important.
There are hundreds of these wilderness study areas scattered across the Mountain West. Daines's legislation on cutting them back in Montana is moving through the Senate. The state's lone congressman, Republican Greg Gianforte, just introduced companion legislation in the House. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Phillipsburg, Montana.
Legislative controversy, how coal companies are paying for reclamation, and regulations around disposing coal ash. These are a few of the issues those in energy were talking about this past week. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim helps break down what all of it means in a back and forth with Connie Wilbert, the head of the Sierra Club's Wyoming chapter.
Thanks for joining us. Like we said, there's been so much going on this week. There was a severance tax exemption bill that was voted down. There was talk of a proposed revision to limit self-bonding, right, by coal companies, a rollback in coal ash disposal regulations. So let's just start with the legislative side of things. Can you talk about the severance tax bill that failed and why it matters?
Basically, that bill proposed to reduce the severance taxes that we collect on oil and gas production. I believe it was in the third and fourth year of production after a well came online. And we were opposed to that legislation and were very glad to see that it did not go forward. And the reason is because it is very well documented that reducing severance taxes does not stimulate either production of the mineral or jobs in that industry.
A lot of supporters were saying people weren't understanding the point of it. If you cut taxes, especially compared to other more competitive states, it could boost development and then tax revenue.
No, in fact, just the opposite. The legislature commissioned a study several years ago done by UW, a very solid analysis of that very question, and it clearly showed that reducing severance taxes does not boost production and it does not boost employment numbers. All it does is decrease revenue to the state. And this is not the time when we should be intentionally decreasing revenue for the state of Wyoming.
Let's move on to the statewide proposed revision to self-bonding. It's been in the process for a while. I think since back in November, there was discussion about limiting the 100% self-bonding. So states like Wyoming wouldn't be left high and dry in reclamation if there was a bankruptcy like there was. Can you explain what this proposed revision means?
Coal companies have been allowed by the state of Wyoming to self-bond, and that means that they can guarantee, based on the financial strength of their company, that they will be responsible for cleaning up after the coal mining is done, reclamation. Under self-bonding, they're not required to basically have insurance. What these proposed rule changes relate to the fact that three of the largest coal corporations in the United States went bankrupt. And it was especially troubling and worrisome for Wyoming because they were self-bonded. That meant they might not cover those costs of reclaiming the coal mines in Wyoming. And so because of those bankruptcies, they decided that they should tighten things up. And these proposed regulation changes are a big step in the right direction because they really do tighten up the way that companies are evaluated for financial security to assess how stable they are for the long term. And that's a big improvement. And they don't allow companies to be 100% self-bonded.
And the public comment period goes until March 28th, I believe, for these proposed revisions. So the last thing I want to touch on is the Trump administration's announcement that it wants to change coal ash disposal regulations. They were imposed by Obama in 2015 after several spills. The change would likely give states and utilities more power, but some people see it as a rollback. Can you say what the regulations are and what's happening now?
Sure. Basically, the problem with coal ash is that it's a really toxic byproduct of burning coal. So every coal-fired power plant, including everyone in Wyoming, produces coal ash, and they have to deal with it. And the material contains a lot of highly toxic products, including arsenic and lead and selenium. It can have radioactive materials in it. And the concern is that if it leaks into surrounding waterways or if it's stored dry and blows into the air, it's a huge public safety issue. So we have been advocating for a long time that We needed strong baseline federal regulations, and we finally got that really in 2015. And this proposed rollback of those federal standards is extremely disappointing. And this is a very serious subject that could affect the health and safety of many, many people all over the country, including right here in Wyoming. So, yeah, there are a number of examples around the state where a failure of the impoundments would have serious impacts on the communities nearby.
Thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, how the University of Wyoming handles sexual assaults and a look at Cheyenne's affordable housing struggles. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Last fall, students walked out of class and gathered in protest of the University of Wyoming's handling of sexual assault. The 45 or so students delivered a letter to President Lori Nichols explaining how the current practices made them feel frustrated and unsafe. One of those students recently filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education Office for Civil Rights, asking the federal government to investigate UW and its Army ROTC program. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson has more.
On a Sunday evening, Q Quallen is working off some stress at the rock climbing gym. This senior, double majoring in wildlife and natural resources, has had a rough past year.
When I'm climbing, it's like a puzzle that I have to solve, so it's the only thing that actually distracts me enough right now.
Quallen focuses on moving up the vertical wall one tiny fake rock at a time, just his fingertips and toes making contact.
Trusting your hands and your grip, though, because the holds don't look good, but I'll hold you, unlike a lot of things.
The University of Wyoming is on that list of things that Quallen says are not so reliable. Quallen was a cadet in UW's Army ROTC program, receiving top honors on his way to serving the country as an Army chaplain.
You can't take your friends and family out on the battlefield, but you can take God. So I really just wanted to be somebody who could help people that needed that to see that.
That dream was disrupted, Quallen says, following several experiences with sexual misconduct while in ROTC. Quallen feels like there's a pattern of mishandling these kinds of allegations by both ROTC leadership and university officials. Last year, Quallen and several other cadets came forward about an ROTC staff member who had sexually harassed them. Quallen says that when Lieutenant Colonel Haas, who commands the program, learned that sexual harassment was happening among his ranks, he demanded that all cadets disclose their experiences and question the morals of those uncertain about speaking up.
I understand the sentiment behind it. He just really wanted to get this guy. But at the same time, there's a complete lack of sensitivity there for the survivor experience.
The Me Too movement has demonstrated that it can take years for sexual assault survivors to accept what happened, let alone report it. The ROTC staff person was ultimately fired, but Quallen says the pressure to report had a negative impact on many of the cadets.
For several days, my apartment was just filled with mostly like freshmen and sophomores who were just lost and confused and terrified and were trying to process and figure things out way quicker than they should ever have to. And
Quallen says that brought on a deep sense of hopelessness and despair. And that, compounded with previous experiences with sexual violence as a teenager, led Quallen to a suicide attempt and brief hospitalization. The same week he was released from the hospital, he received an award.
Got out of the hospital on a Monday, went to that award ceremony on Wednesday to actually accept an award for the top cadet of the semester.
It was a lot to handle in a very short period of time. The next day, Quallen was hanging out with some ROTC friends at a bar, trying to lighten the mood of the last couple weeks. At the end of the night, Quallen and a fellow cadet were the last members of the group left. There was alcohol involved, and the details are fuzzy, so Quallen says he's not sure how they ended up going home together, but they did.
The night as a whole is pretty fragmented. But the short of it being, I basically woke up to being assaulted. by him in his home.
Researchers say fragmented memory is common for survivors. Fear and trauma impair the parts of the brain that create structured memories. So while a detailed sequence of events isn't there, Qualen remembers drifting in and out of consciousness, being restrained, and sexually assaulted. Qualen confided in a friend in ROTC who, in an attempt to help, told a superior officer. Qualen knew the report would travel up to Colonel Haas.
So I went in and spoke to him, and he was like, okay, well, I'm calling the sheriff's department because it's in their jurisdiction.
Looking back on that experience, Qualen says it would have been less traumatic to first talk to a counselor at the university rather than immediately facing law enforcement.
And I was just kind of, like, caught up in everything and honestly didn't know that. But he was like, this is what we do. So I was like, okay.
Ultimately, after completing a rape kit and several interviews, the county declined to take Qualen's case. It's not rare for sexual assaults to dead end at a police report, especially when alcohol is involved and the details are murky. When students are involved, universities can offer ongoing support even when criminal cases don't move forward. UW's Title IX office, in collaboration with the Dean of Students' office, is responsible for these services. But Qualen says they haven't been stepping in on ROTC cases.
If it makes it to my desk, then I'm obligated to do something.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Haas with the UW Army ROTC program. When reports come in, he says he instigates an internal Army investigation, and if he thinks the alleged sexual misconduct is criminal, he also contacts local law enforcement. But he didn't initially mention contacting the university's Title IX office, so I asked why.
Well, no, so I guess the other part of that is I have an obligation to keep the university in the loop, keep the Title IX office in the loop, and that's often what happens. So I'm usually, if it's criminal, I'm talking to law enforcement, I'm talking to my chain of command, I'm talking to my university chain of command, and I'm talking to the Title IX office.
So I reached out to Title IX office coordinator Jim Osborne to confirm university policy.
ROTC staff are considered mandatory reporters at the University of Wyoming, so if they're aware of reports of sexual misconduct, they're bound by university policy to make those reports.
As far as he's concerned, that's happening.
And I don't have any record that I'm not aware of any reports where ROTC has not made a report to my office.
I asked him about Qualen, and he said he couldn't comment on specific cases. I went hypothetical instead.
So if a student doesn't hear from you, and they know that a mandated reporter has information about their assault, then we know that there's like a broken link somewhere.
Probably. And if a student has not been contacted, one of the things that I would hope they would do is contact us themselves.
That's what Alexia Huffman had to do. She's a junior who wants to go active duty when she graduates and command a tank. Like Qualen, she first reported sexual misconduct to ROTC.
So I told Lieutenant Colonel Haas that a former cadet hacked into my computer and stole a nude photo of me. And I'm pretty sure he's been stalking and looking into my computer and into my phone for years.
Huffman says Haas took action and kicked her stalker out of ROTC, but he's still a student at UW. She waited to hear how the university would handle that aspect of her case.
The dean of students knew that this kid did this to me, but they never emailed me or came to me to, like, find out more information.
Huffman says she had to contact them twice before getting a response. Now she's talked to the dean of students, the Title IX office, and a sexual violence advocate on campus, but isn't confident anything is actually happening. Dr. Matt Gray isn't surprised she feels that way.
When you're trying to navigate a really difficult system and trying to figure out what's going to be helpful for you, having to also grapple with that concern about how seriously your concerns are going to be taken and how well you're going to be believed is something that is an additional barrier that a lot of other trauma survivors don't have to grapple with.
Gray supervises a treatment clinic for survivors of sexual violence through UW's psychology department. He says while universities have a mandate to respond effectively, UW is not alone in its struggle to figure out how to do so.
It's good that there are all of these entities that are charged formally with the responsibility of being able to support survivors, but it can be pretty overwhelming that there's all of these different entities that potentially intersect with reports of sexual violence.
Potentially seems like the key word. Quallen says where there could be intersections, there are gaps. His suicide attempt was a red flag for the military, and he's no longer in ROTC. He hopes his complaint with the Office for Civil Rights will help explain why students don't feel they're getting the support the university says they are guaranteed. For Wyoming Public Radio, with help from Annie Osborne, I'm Tennessee Watson.
While budget cutting and education may have been in the headlines, the Wyoming legislature did pass a number of economic development measures this legislative session. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck speaks with Jeremiah Riemann, who's the governor's director of economic diversification strategy and initiatives.
So, Jeremiah, let's go ahead and start and just talk a little bit about some of the legislation this session. A lot of people listening wonder if there's just been nothing but chaos at the legislature, but there's been some good legislation and some I know Endow has been hoping for. One of those, I think, deals with airlines.
Yeah, one of the bright spots has been Endow, and air service has been a critical component of the effort that we've advanced this legislative session. And the bodies ultimately came around a program that we've been encouraging that the Department of Transportation put together, which will ultimately allow us to enter into a contract, a long-term contract for commercial air service in a number of communities across this state where it's vital to have that air service, not only for the businesses that are there today, but for the businesses we would like to recruit in the future.
There was some opposition, especially I thought in the House, to the $15 million piece, which you'll need to, I guess, let the airline carriers know that you're, what the state means it, will really be partners with them long term.
Yeah, you know, certainly there was that group that felt, go out, negotiate the contract, and come back to us and tell us what the amount is. I think we came from the approach of it's better to have the funding up front so that we can actually demonstrate that we are serious rather than having to come back to a body of 90 people and ultimately ask them to support that.
There are people, I heard even before the session, that wondered if why would government get involved in something like this and had some concerns about that. Could you respond to that?
Yeah, you know, and we talk about this in our report. Wyoming is a state, a large state, small population, and we run up against barriers, market forces that sometimes don't work in our favor, whether that's broadband service or air service or a number of other perhaps governmental related services. And this is one of those areas where it's going to take a concerted effort, a public-private partnership, and ultimately to advance this. This isn't the state owning an airline. This is the state contracting with an airline provider, making sure that we have regular flights into communities and not be at the whim of contracts.
You mentioned broadband. Let's transition to that. Actually, that was a bill that didn't seem to have much controversy, at least when I was sitting in on the discussions. What did the legislation pass? What will that do?
Ultimately, it'll allow for us to have a couple of things. One, we'll be able to hire a broadband coordinator as well as to seat an advisory council that can give us better advice and information about what the broadband coverage is in this state. There's a lot of information out there, some of it correct, a lot of misinformation. So that'll be a critical component to allow us to map that out, to do speed tests and ensure we know where to best place our funding in the future. It also gave us $10 million that can be granted out for public-private partnerships to lay additional conduit and fiber across this state and those unserved communities. And when I say that, unserved includes areas where there might be service, but it's not adequate, or at least at the level that the FCC has defined for advanced telecommunications. So we'll be able to begin partnering that with the private dollars that will be matched or the federal funding. There's considerable amount of money out there. The president and his proposed budget has advanced rural broadband as one element of that. This will allow for that funding to come into that account if they ultimately appropriate it as a block grant. and allow us to distribute it even further out into communities.
That seems like, so these were two of the bigger priorities of Endow.
Air service was the number one priority. Broadband was right behind it. But we had a number of other priorities this legislative session. We wanted to ensure that we had workforce training funding to properly prepare for the businesses that we have that are creating new jobs and equally those that are coming in. We also felt it was important to continue to develop the entrepreneurial ecosystem, which is really fragile in this state in comparison to all of our neighboring states. So that was a critical component, and hopefully we can get that through the legislature today.
Yeah, as we're talking, that one has just another step or two to go, but it's I know you've got to be awfully excited. The goal is to try and diversify the economy. You've got some legislation, including when you throw in the blockchain stuff, that looks like you're headed in that direction.
Yeah, you know, I'm tremendously excited. The Executive Council put out a report at the end of December. Later that in January, the governor signed two executive orders immediately off of that. And for some context, the governor signed two executive orders total last year, so it's very rare for him to do that. Now we've come into the legislative session. We've had incredible support from both bodies, and we've passed three bills so far, two more to go. And the total funding package is considerable. We'll be somewhere between $28 and $40 million worth of investment.
Jeremiah Riemann, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Cheyenne's local government has been putting a lot of work behind its Fight the Blight campaign to address a number of abandoned houses and rundown buildings. But efforts to clean those places up have revealed another problem, a lack of affordable housing. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen has more.
Soon after Cheyenne Mayor Marion Orr took office in 2017, she formed the Fight the Blight Committee. Orr says there are several abandoned properties in the community that have been taken over by all kinds of things.
By squatters and drug dealers and other criminal activity, raccoons, skunks. It's nobody wants an abandoned property next to theirs or next to their grandmother's or their mother's.
Orr asked the committee to come up with a list of areas in town that needed to be addressed. At the top of the list, a trailer park in South Cheyenne.
This particular trailer park has not been really held accountable for meeting codes.
Orr says the city was concerned with four trailers in the park after an inspection revealed no connection to water, sewer, gas, or electric services. The trailers weren't always occupied, though. They used to be boarded up. Mayor Orr says last year when the park came under new management, landlord Robert Wink decided to put them to use.
He knew of some people that were in need of homes, and he has a very good heart and thought that perhaps unboarding these structures and allowing individuals and families to move into these units was somehow better than their current situation.
Landlord Robert Wink declined multiple requests from Wyoming Public Radio for an interview. Mayor Orr says because the trailers were not fit for human beings, the city posted notices of code violations on the four trailers. Residents would need to bring their homes up to code, or they would have to find somewhere else to live. But the problem wouldn't be solved if tenants simply left the park.
I think that is absolutely the root of all of this, is the lack of affordable housing here.
That's Lori Kempter. She's executive director of Family Promise, the sole family-only shelter in Cheyenne. According to the Wyoming Business Council, there's a housing shortage in every county in the state. To meet housing demands, Cheyenne, a city of about 64,000 people, would need 12,000 more units. Kempter says people underestimate how many experience homelessness in the area. That's because it looks different in Wyoming. Oftentimes, it's people crashing with family or in motels and their cars.
We serve usually between 15 and 20 families a year with emergency shelter. And the majority of the last 12 months, we have operated with a waiting list upwards of 15 families at a time.
The same goes for the other homeless shelter in Cheyenne, Comia. Executive Director at Comia, Robin Bocanegra, says it is almost always operating at full capacity.
We always end up with this pocket of people that, because of the lack of services, there's just nowhere for them to go.
Bocanegra says those limited services would help people become more self-sufficient.
And it's really hard for us then to find or to make room for new people that are experiencing homelessness because we're full of the folks that we have nowhere to place them.
Comia and Family Promise each receive about $10,000 a year from the city, and some of that money is set to run out in 2019.
Bocanegra says there could be more beds and services provided if they had more funding.
$10,000 is nothing. You know, and when I look at how many people we're taking off the streets and trying to help them, that's a community issue.
Both shelters say they would like to see the city take a greater interest in combating homelessness. Mayor Marion Orr sees things differently.
I don't believe that it's up to city government to solve it because it's a much larger social issue, and we simply don't have that bandwidth, that capability within city government.
Lori Kempter with Family Promise says the problem is bigger than local government. She says it's Wyoming's weak landlord-tenant laws that cause people to live in the conditions seen at the trailer park in South Cheyenne.
They're not choosing to live in conditions that are not meant for human habitation and that don't have the same basic necessities that you and I have. They're doing that because they have nowhere else to go. And so for a landlord to be able to legally rent places out to people that don't have all of those basic necessities, I mean, that's a really bad law.
It's not clear what will happen to the trailer park in South Cheyenne. Lori Kempter says Family Promise will be stopping by this weekend to hand out flyers with information on community resources. She says if residents do have to vacate in the future, she hopes there's room at the shelter. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Ahead, we'll wrap up the show with a chat with lawmakers about their education funding work. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Education was a main topic of discussion during most of the legislative session. As the legislature comes to a close, K-12 education took a $30 million cut, and a couple of constitutional amendments that could have done further damage failed. Senate Education Chairman Hank Coe and Senate Minority Leader Chris Rothfuss join Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck to size up what happened.
Senator Coe, you've been a longtime supporter of education, but in the last few years, you have supported a lot of these cuts. Explain to folks why.
Well, I think, my approach to it has been, and I was here when we started funding education better, as was Senator Rothfuss. He and I worked together on a lot of stuff. But my approach was initially that if, you know, through the recalibration process, if you look at what we saw from market analysis, from salary structures, we were spending significantly more than surrounding states, the adjoining states to us, the closest to us being Montana at $5,000 per student less than us, that I felt that we could make some reductions, hopefully sustain our good school system, that there was some fluff in there that we could take out. And so that's kind of been my approach all along. Now, I will say that a lot of that approach is Senate leadership approach as well, mm-hmm. To make some reductions before we do revenue raising. That's probably the major difference between the House and the Senate.
I want to just push back a little bit, and because one of the things, when I listen to Senate leadership talk sometimes, it almost sounds like it's my fault or it's the teacher's fault or it's the principal's fault that we're in this situation with education. Isn't it truthfully, I'm going to tease you now, but isn't it truthfully your fault?
Well, I don't have any question about it. The legislature is the one that, you know, legislative grace. We talked about that again on the floor today. We take an evidence-based model from consultants and we tack on all the ornaments on the Christmas tree, mm-hmm. to the tune of another $75 million. And we pretty much made our bet in this deal. You know, going back the last 10 years, there's no question about it. We're the ones that chose to do legislative grace. We're the ones that chose to fund education at the level we're funding it.
So I'll ask you a tough question. Isn't it fair, though, that with some of the spending they've done, that you could come back and probably cut some money?
Well, over the last 3 or 4 years, I think we've taken all of those ornaments off the Christmas tree and sold them, realistically. It's at a point now where we are at or below the actual consultant's model. We did another recalibration this last year. They came up with a recommendation for a cost of around $70 million more than what we're spending right now. So we definitely did have legislative grace 6 or so years ago. But at this point in time, it really isn't there anymore. We are at or slightly below that amount of money.
One of the things that's happened, in fact, it's happened in the last couple of weeks, is we're seeing a number of superintendents that are starting to resign, and I think some of them are suggesting publicly it is because of some of this and some of this attitude. How much of a concern is it as you look forward, knowing you've got teacher retirements coming and that kind of thing, that there could be some setbacks in education?
I don't know. I wasn't aware the superintendents were resigning. You know, the life of a superintendent in a district is pretty limited anyway, normally. One of the things we did find out in the recalibration is that the administrators are paid significantly, on the average around the state, higher than what the model provides. And, you know, that's in there. There's just no question about that. Even my good buddy Senator Raffles would agree to that.
Even I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is true. We see about 30% over what the model says, and when you look at neighboring states, it still looks high.
That sounds like a local control issue again.
It's a local control. I think we got to remember that we fund all 48 districts with a block grant. You know, it's made up of components that have recommended funding, but they still get a block grant. They can still spend the money any way they want to, and so that's why we see over 600 non-hired teachers that the model provides across the state. Districts have chosen to pay their teachers better, pay their superintendents better, and that's their local control. That's why they're local elected boards.
Sounds like you need to be one of the speakers of the School Board Association and ask them not to pay so much.
I don't know if that'd be a good idea, Bob. You know.
We're visiting with Senators Hank Coe and Chris Rothfuss as we wrap up the session a little bit. Let me just jump to this. You did some good things for education. There was some interesting legislation this year, some things that really might improve things. And, you know, the one that jumps out right away is this computer science.
Computer science has been a win-win, and today was a remarkable day because the House passed our Senate file 29-59-1 or something like that. But the good senator from Laramie and I, we worked on this in the interim. We had wonderful, wonderful testimony, particularly by a young group from Powell. And so the computer science is a real win because this is the future for our young people. Absolutely no question about it as they go into society and, you know, the workplace. So that was a win-win, no question about it.
Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm very enthused about it also. And Senator Coe and I have been trying to strengthen math, science, and absolutely math, science, and computer education for several years now. And this is probably the best piece of legislation that we've seen pass that does that. We were really aggressive with it. It's a piece of legislation that puts us out in front of what other states are doing, where we're promulgating standards for computer science, and we're basically requiring that all students in the state throughout their K-12 education get exposure to computer science and computational thinking, and that really will put us ahead of the pack.
Okay, so we've got a funding issue in the state, I think, and it's how do you resolve the revenue situation? Have you cut what you can cut?
Close. I think we're pretty close. I think that came out in this session. You know, we sent Senate File 117 over to the House, and that had $75 million in it. I think there are those, we just had quite a debate on the floor, there are those on the floor here in the Senate that think that we should cut more, but I think we're pretty close. I think, you know, we're spending money that we have right now. You know, the House's approach was to do diversions in the budget bill, but our approach was to spend money, and that includes the LSRA, mm-hmm. Legislative Stabilization Reserve Account, which is our rainy day fund. We're in better shape to deal with this budget shortfall than we were 10, 12 years ago when I dealt with the last time, because yeah. Now permanent mental trust fund's $8 billion. We have $1.5 billion in a rainy day fund, and so things are better. I don't know. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I think we're in a position right now where we have to really be serious about diversifying our revenue, and we've talked before about that. It's not just a matter of let's raise taxes. It's really a matter of let's be thoughtful about what the tax structure in Wyoming in the future needs to look like if we're trying to diversify the economy, because we don't have a tax structure that can deal with a diversified economy. Somebody the other day said that we should de-diversify the economy because the only thing we tax is coal, oil, and gas, and I thought, yeah, that's probably accurate at this point. We have a significant revenue shortfall, around $900 million for the next biennium, and we can patchwork cover that internally through investment revenue and through savings. But you can't sustain that. That's not something that in the long run is going to be workable.
Even if you did what the House did, you're just, you know, I hate to use this term, but you are doing it, kicking the can down the road.
Yes, the term I use is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, realistically. It, that's what we're doing. New revenue is essential. That does mean new taxes or different taxes. And there's no way we can just bank on Wall Street to continue to provide the yields they're providing and solve our problems.
Yeah, diversification. I mean, you know, we've been very successful with a company up in my place. And you've been really, you know, Cody Labs, you've been very successful in Laramie with what's going on over there. Cody Labs is just, you know, on its way to employ 350 people. That's the kind of stuff we need, but they still, through assessed valuation of commercial assessed valuation, 11.5% of market, it's still going to take so much of that to pick up the slack that Minerals used to carry.
And so maybe as we have these revenue discussions, we get off the traditional stuff and focus more on what's necessary.
Yeah, we talk about the idea that we want to add manufacturing. That's a great example. But we have so many tax exemptions and so little taxation on manufacturing that if we added 500 new manufacturing jobs, it wouldn't produce the tax base to pay for the families of those individuals. It'd be a net liability for the state. So it isn't just a matter of that economic diversification to help us pay the bills and pay for education. It really is a matter of figuring out how we should appropriately tax those diverse industries. And Cody Labs is an example where if we did an analysis, they probably wouldn't be paying the way of the families and their needs on the society up there. And instead, that's then being compensated for by the oil and gas industry and coal.
Senators Chris Rothfuss and Co., a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear the entire program or individual segments, go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Anna Rader is our web editor.
If there are issues you'd like to see us cover on this program, you can submit those through our Facebook page or on our website.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.